Good morning. My name is Dwayne Montani, and my left is Miguel Velasco. We are representing Mr. Becerra. This matter comes before you. You judge it on the result of a guilty verdict that was rendered in Adams County as a result of a jury trial. Mr. Becerra was found guilty of sexual assault on a child pattern, sexual assault on a child, and sexual assault on a child by the use of force. He was subsequently sentenced by the Adams County District Court, and this appeal has been perfected on his behalf. There are three issues that we are asking that you look at today. One of them pertains to the overall charge of the court to the jury as to what the jury function should be. The biggest complaint that we have on that is that the court did not at any point in time indicate to the jury that they were limited to the evidence was presented by the prosecution. And further, the court basically told the jury, you figure out what happened. And we do not feel that is the status of the law. The second issue is the failure of the court to grant a peremptory challenge to one of the prospective jurors. And then the third issue is the court's acceptance of a sane expert and allowing testimony and opinions from that individual. So with that in mind, the juror that was questioned by the court, there was a general voir dire that was done in the court of the jury panel. And in the voir dire, the court used an example and inquired of the panel, specifically inquired of this juror pertaining to a standard of guilt versus innocence. And that was the extent that was done by the court. There was a jury questionnaire that was used by the trial court, and this particular juror expressed concern in when he filled out the jury questionnaire as to whether he could be fair and impartial. Defense counsel was able to ask questions of the juror, and basically the juror replied that the juror felt like that he could not be fair and impartial, that he would have difficulty following the presumption of innocence with respect to Mr. Becerra. The wife of the juror ran a daycare, cared for children, and also had a situation where she cared for children in law enforcement. The prospective juror that we are complaining about in this case indicated to the court that he felt that he would have difficulty and he would not be able to be fair and impartial. I think that's admitted by the people in their reply brief that they filed. And further, upon questioning by defense counsel, the juror said that he had doubts and concerns whether he could be fair and impartial.
Mr. Velasco, what exactly was it that you claim this potential juror said that manifested a lack of impartiality and a lack of prejudice? What did he exactly say?
His responses, which he exactly said, were the following. He was asked about being able to be fair. And that is found, it's quoted on the reply brief at page 8 and page 9 and page 10. On the defense counsel, says, what I'm hearing from you is that experience, that background, may very well make it difficult for you to be fair.
Let me interrupt you just a moment. You said the reply brief, but I think you mean the government, the people's answer brief.
Answer brief.
Okay, I'm looking at the same page. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
I'm sorry, and thank you for pointing that out. It may very well make it difficult for you to be fair in a case like this that involves similar kinds of allegations you're concerned with. Is that right? And the juror responds, yes. Further, the defense counsel indicates that he said, what I'm hearing from you is that you have some doubts and concerns that you would be able to do that. Is that correct?
And what does that refer to? It's
that refers to the paragraph right above it, which says, and you know, in an ideal world, we could always be fair. But I think you understand, correct me if I'm wrong, that it's important for Mr. Becerra to have 12 people who can be fair and impartial. So it pertains to the standard of fair and impartial.
But then the juror said, I agree with that. The juror says, I think I agree that Mr. Becerra has to have a jury that's fair and impartial.
Yes, but then he follows up by saying he cannot be fair and impartial.
After the defense counsel uses the word, you have some doubts, they sort of, it seems to me, I wonder if the defense counsel didn't put words in the mouth of the juror, so to speak, by asking what we would call a leading question.
Well, I think that's part of what defense counsel should do when they're selecting the jury. But the thing is, you know, it could have been just as easily for the jury to answer no to the defense counsel, but he didn't. He left it with the impression that he could not be fair and impartial. In fact, is he affirmatively answered that he could not be fair and impartial. And I think what's important here, Judge, is the fact that neither the prosecution nor the trial court rehabilitated this juror to any extent. There were no questions asked about his responses on the jury questionnaire. There were no questions asked about his responses to defense counsel. So it basically stayed before the court that the juror said he could not be fair and impartial. He also indicated he had doubts and concerns. I mean, I don't know how much clearer this juror could have been. The very next sentence says, so at least at this stage you have some doubts or concerns about being able to listen to the evidence fairly and presume him innocent in this case. That strikes to the very heart of a jury trial, the presumption of innocence. And the juror goes on to say that he believes he has a problem presuming Mr. Becerra innocent, and he has some doubts and concerns as to whether he can be fair. This juror should have been removed by the trial court.
There are cases, though, that say if the juror's answer is ambiguous or it's equivocal, he doesn't have to be removed. I'm not sure if this case falls under the equivocal answer or not, because when the juror says, I do believe I have a problem about that, it's hard for me to understand exactly what the juror meant when he said that. I mean, I understand you want to refer back to, he refers back to what the defense counsel said, but I'm not sure if the answer was equivocal or if the answer was really agreeing with defense counsel. It seems a little bit equivocal to me. Can we just say that if it's equivocal, we've got to defer to what the trial judge observes? The trial judge may have observed that this juror was not biased.
Well, I do not read it that way because of the fact that I think we have to take this in context as how it came out. Defense counsel was examining this juror and he was asking him about various things about had been fair and impartial, and he raised the issue of doubts and concerns, he raised the issue of presumption of innocence. Now, what you pointed out on his response, which is on page 10 of the answer brief, I think that's clear. It says, I do believe I have a problem about that. I mean, that is as clear as can be, that he has a problem on the presumption, and he has a problem with being fair and impartial, as he has doubts and concerns about that. I don't think that he fluctuated on that at all.
Mr. Montano?
Yes, sir.
Pardon me for interrupting, if I may, please.
Yes.
Aren't we sort of handicapped here because we weren't in the courtroom and the trial court judge was? So on issues such as inflection, intensity, hesitation, firmness or lack of firmness in statements, we have no idea what those things were. And isn't that one reason that our Supreme Court has told us that we need in these cases to thoughtfully defer to the trial court's rulings?
Well, and I may agree with you if the trial court would have inquired of this juror on any of these issues, or the prosecution have inquired of any of these issues, but they did not. They left it exactly as it was, and I think the record speaks for itself.
But didn't he make statements beforehand that suggested that he would be fair and impartial?
So as it pertains to the guilt-innocent portion, that's the only thing that he would talk about and talk to you about the trial court, was about guilt-innocence and the standard of guilt-innocence. And I think the example the court used was obtaining gas and not getting a receipt. I don't know if I answered your question or not, Judge Bernard.
Please go ahead, Mr. McCarthy. Thank you.
Okay. But anyway, what I'm indicating to you is that it's our position that Mr. Becerra's defense counsel had to use a peremptory challenge to remove this particular juror when the judge refused to remove him, and he went ahead and removed that juror. He went ahead, selected the jury, and but for the trial court's error, he would not have to have used the peremptory challenge that he did use. Now, our position basically is that just on the basis of the failure to grant the peremptory challenge, this case ought to be reversed. And it ought to be reversed because it was arbitrary, it was unreasonable, it was unfair for the trial court not to remove this particular juror, and he should have removed this particular juror. Now, as it pertains to the sane expert, the court admitted the expert under 702, and under 702, basically what the court found was that the expert could go ahead and give testimony. However, the testimony that was given by the individual opined her interpretation of what some photographs depicted, and we do not feel that she was qualified to give such testimony, and the court should not have allowed such testimony to be given. She replied that she was waiting to see if she was certified as the same expert, and at this point that she testified, she was not certified as the same expert and should not have been allowed to testify. And I think we'll save the remainder of our time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
Good morning. My name is Nishama Hutchinson, bar number 33306, appearing on behalf of the state of Colorado. May it please court. The trial court did not abuse its discretion in denying the challenge for cause because the juror in question, jurist, did not make any clear and unequivocal statement of bias toward the defendant in this case. As Judge Bernard has pointed out earlier, the trial court's denial of the challenge for cause should only be set aside when the record discloses clear abuse of discretion, meaning that the entire voir dire must be examined in context.
Well, counsel, I want to stop you there. What exactly does the juror have to be clear about? If the juror clearly expresses a doubt about the ability to be impartial, isn't that enough under the case law? In other words, the juror doesn't have to say, I can't be fair. It's enough if the juror says, I don't think I can.
No, Your Honor, there have been several cases in which this court has indicated that a juror's indication that they have doubts and concerns based on experience that they bring with them into the court as a juror is not enough to sustain a challenge for cause. I would point out People v. Ferrero, that is 874 P. 2nd, 468. And in that case, the trial court noted that a prospective juror's expression of concern or a preconceived notion that they bring in does not automatically require exclusion, unless you have a situation where the juror evidences some unyielding belief that they cannot be fair in case.
Well, here, the last word we have is that the juror had such a belief. We don't have any rehabilitative questioning by anybody.
Your Honor,
do you have a case that indicates that where a juror persists in indicating a doubt about the ability to be fair, and there is no rehabilitative questioning, that it was okay to deny the challenge?
I would make 2 points in response to the question. First of all, I would say under People v. Merrill, that's 181 P3rd 319, rehabilitation is only required in an instance where the statements by the juror compel an inference that they are unable to be fair. I think in this situation we don't have a statement that would compel that inference. And the statement in Merrill, the court will recall, was made by a potential juror who stated, "I am not going to count the testimony of anyone who is under the influence of drugs." That is an unequivocal statement that compels the inference. Now, the context of this voir dire, first of all, remembering that the juror was initially questioned by the trial court, and the trial court did ask questions of the juror about his ability to set aside preconceived beliefs about the defendant, and the juror indicated in response to those questions he could do so. Then we have questioning by the defense counsel. I think it's important to note the questioning that took place to the juror immediately preceding juror S. The question immediately preceding the voir dire of juror S, in this case by defense counsel, and this is to another juror, is, "Do you think that probably you would not be able to be fair to defendant and give him a fair trial based on your experiences?" That juror said, "I would say yes." Then defense counsel moved on to juror S, and he said, "Same question to you." Juror S then talked about the personal experience he brought into the case, and then he distinguished himself from the juror that had just answered, and he said, I may be able to be fair." Now,
But counsel, isn't the defendant entitled to a juror who is a little more certain about their ability to be fair than "I may be able to be fair"? They're entitled to a juror who is clear about their ability to be fair.
Yes, and I think the juror indicated in his responses to the court that he understood the basic concepts of criminal law and that he was able to be fair. And it is impossible for us, on the basis of this record, to really know the inflection to which he provided that answer. But I think given the sequencing of the questions, it becomes clear that his answer was made to distinguish himself from the unequivocal nature of the statement made by the juror before him. And then as he moves on, he talks a little bit more about his wife and the daycare that she provides and his interaction with children based on that. He agrees that he's perhaps hypersensitive, and that it's only in response to these really vague and qualified leading questions that he responds in the affirmative. I mean, first of all, the defense counsel asks, "Based on your experience, would you have difficulty?" Well, as the trial court noted, given the nature of the allegations in this case, most of the jurors would probably have a lot of difficulty with the subject matter of the case. The other questions are equally qualified by defense counsel. So what you're saying is, at this point, at this stage, you have some doubts or concerns. But that doesn't rise to the level of a statement in People v. Merrill, where the juror said, "I cannot accept the testimony of anyone who is a drug user." So rehabilitation was not required under the circumstances here.
Well, I want to go back to the court's questioning, because the court's questioning at the beginning was only the most general questioning. It was just of the entire panel out there explaining some general concepts. And kind of in a vacuum, does anybody have a problem with what I've just explained, which was the presumption of innocence, the requirement of proof beyond a reasonable doubt, in a vacuum? But the defense counsel here is focusing in on the particular experiences of this prospective juror, is more specific. It's not simply a situation where you might imagine that because of the nature of the case, anyone might have some difficulty. This particular juror had particular experiences in their past, which that particular juror thought might make it more difficult in a case like this. So given that there was nothing, no follow-up after these responses, and the prospective juror was consistent in expressing doubt about the ability to be fair, but we have a problem here.
Well, I would point out 2 things, Your Honor. First of all, defense counsel has made a lot of reference to statements by the juror in the juror questionnaire, and I would point out that the questionnaire is not part of the record on appeal. It's not found within the record as designated. So it's impossible for us to even know sort of the kickoff point to the conversation. The most we know is that we're sort of in the ballpark here, and that something he said on the questionnaire had to do with his wife providing daycare to children. This is a very different situation from other cases cited by defendant, where you have prospective jurors who are either victims of the exact type of crime that is an issue in the case. Here we have a juror who is, his wife is a daycare provider, bringing this case sort of very similarly to Morrison v. People, 19P3-668, that's a Colorado Supreme Court case in 2000. That case also involved cases involving sexual assault on children, and the prospective juror in that case indicated she was predisposed to find the defendant guilty based on the fact he was accused of sexual assault and because she was a parent and involved in elementary education. And the Supreme Court upheld the trial court's denial of the challenge for cause in that case and found that none of those statements indicated that she was unable to afford the defendant the presumption of innocence. And it is very difficult, as this court knows, on a cold record such as this, when we are really confined solely to the transcript in this case, we don't have the questionnaire, to know what it was to put ourselves in the position of the trial court and to observe what he did about the demeanor and the sincerity of the juror, which is why, in cases where it's difficult to do so, deference should be given to the trial court.
Well, how is this case distinguishable from Lumen? I'm sure you're familiar with that case.
Yes, Your Honor. But in Lumen, you have a juror who has a very direct and immediate connection to the allegations in that case. The juror in that case was a person who treated victims of sexual assault. She says she herself was possibly a victim of sex assault. There was a history of sex assault in her family. And throughout questioning, she continually indicated that this history would make it impossible for her to view the evidence in an objective manner. We don't have that kind of direct connection in this case, and we don't have the kind of statements of impossibility here. We don't have what was present in Merrill, which is a sort of an unqualified statement that compels the inference that there's no other possible explanation, that there's no other way the juror could possibly be fair. And I don't think we have those kind of unequivocal statements here. We have a juror who brought in their personal experience, which is what we want our jurors to do. We want them to come into court and bring their background in. And in cases involving children, a lot of jurors have a heightened sensitivity to that, and that's not unusual, as the trial court recognized.
I mean, the juror did not say, I cannot be fair. The judge was correct. On the other hand, the juror didn't say, I can't be fair. This falls somewhere in the middle, it seems like. And when it falls somewhere in the middle, what are we supposed to do with these cases? Is the trial judge supposed to err on the side of caution and dismiss the juror? Are we supposed to reverse him and reverse the case because the judge didn't err on the side of caution?
Right.
Or do we defer to the trial judge who's watching the whole situation unfold? It's very difficult. I don't know exactly what the judge thought of, because he does say, according to the transcript of set forth in the brief, he didn't say he cannot be fair. He said, if he had said it could not be fair, I would dismiss it. But he did say it could be fair either. What he said was, in answer to a leading question, I believe I have a problem about that. That's really what the juror said. And I'm not exactly sure what the juror meant when he said I have a problem about that. It's very hard to determine. We can't determine what I'm supposed to do.
What's very difficult, as you point out on the cold record, to know how to put that statement in context. He could have just as easily been referring to his difficulty with the overall subject matter of the case, which would have been reasonable. And I think in a situation such as you perceived, which is the statements are not equivocal here, that is precisely the situation where this court must refer to the trial court, who is in a superior position to judge the credibility and demeanor and sincerity of the witness when they're making a statement.
Did you say the case, when you first stood up there, I thought you referred to a case where the juror actually said, I have some doubt. Your words are actually jurors that have some doubt. Maybe I misunderstood you.
No, this court has held in a couple of cases that merely an expression of doubt and concern, and that's People v. Griffin and People v. Ferrero.
Ferrero?
Yes.
Okay. Is that cited in your brief? I don't think it is. I see it.
I apologize. It's not, Your Honor, that he will be Griffin is the same principle.
Okay.
The prospective juror, in that case, this court found the prospective juror's indication of concern about the ability to set aside a preconceived notion does not automatically warrant their exclusion, particularly when the source of their doubts, and this is a quote, are based on incidents that happen to other individuals and not the juror themselves. And here, once again, this juror's connection to the subject matter is much more attenuated than what occurred in People v. Newman. So it is the people's position that this court should uphold the trial court's denial of the challenge for cause because there are no unequivocal statements of actual bias that compel the inference, and that's the language in People v. Merrow, that compel the inference that this juror had no ability to be fair and impartial. We should defer to the trial court's superior ability to observe the demeanor and the sincerity of the juror and uphold the ruling. I'll turn briefly to the other two issues in this case. The first involves the qualification of the sexual assault nurse examiner witness in this case. As this court is aware, that the review of that ruling is also reviewed under an abuse of discretion. Here, the nurse was qualified under 702, which provides that testimony that's helpful to the trier of fact and where the witness is qualified shall be accepted. I would note that there is no requirement that a witness hold a specific degree or training or certificate. Under the rules, she can be qualified based on either her skill or her experience or training or education. The witness here was well trained. She was an RN. She had a Bachelor of Science in Nursing. She had a certificate in forensic nursing. She worked as an ER nurse for 12 years. She had 60 specialized hours in sexual assault nurse examination. She was aptly met that criteria. It was well within the trial court's discretion to qualify her as an expert.
Counsel, specifically, what was she qualified as an expert in?
The wording in the transcript is a little different. She was qualified as a her title was sexual assault nurse examiner, so I believe the trial court says she's qualified as a in the area of sexual assault nurse examination.
All right, so
the phrase used.
So I'm trying to distinguish between the title and the nature of the testimony that she was to give that required some expertise. What was that? What was the nature of the testimony?
So she was the examining nurse who examined one of the victims when they came into the hospital and took photographs of the injuries of the victim. So what she was able to provide that would not be accessible to a layperson is some context for those photographs. And based on her knowledge, skill, and experience, she was able to say that what she observed was consistent with what the victim reported.
And she gave those observations after she had the 60 hours of experience, right?
That's correct.
The fact that when she examined the girl, she only had, I think they said, 12 hours of experience.
I think
the defendant says something to that effect. Doesn't matter, because she gave the opinion at the time of the trial based on her experience at that time.
That is correct, Your Honor. She, at the time of trial, had performed, had to do with the number of exams she had performed of that specific type of exam. She'd been an RN and an ER nurse for 12 years.
There's time that passed from the time she examined the girl to the time she rendered her opinion. The experience she used up to the time she rendered her opinion was what was the base of her experience at the time of trial.
That's correct, Your Honor. In regard to the very last point, I would note, and this has to do with sort of some general statements made by the trial court to the jury pool at the very beginning of the voir dire. I think taken in context, and those are found at the record, volume 3, page 10 to 20, it becomes evident that there was no error in what the trial court was saying, and certainly nothing that would rise to the level of plain error. There are no further questions.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. May it please the court, I think you need to look at the totality of the circumstances here and look at the whole transcript. The way that this started out is that the client said at the very beginning, I may have some difficulty, but later on, voir dire, the defense clearly showed the problem. So initially it would be difficult. And I would also contend, how could you not be unequivocal versus yes or no? I mean, he could have said no. The prosecution could have objected and said that, you know, that's a leading question. The other thing is, we talked about the judge was in the position to evaluate that stuff. But before I get to that, and I would turn the panel to page 166, lines 17 to 21, where Mr. S. says, if forced in one direction, that he could not change his mind. And so that shows that he couldn't even follow instructions. Again, no rehabilitation of the witness. I think that the government in this case, they talk about some of the statements, but like I said earlier, you need to look at the totality of the circumstances and all the statements, because I think there was, if you look at all of that, that shows that Mr. S. started maybe with some difficulty, but as he came through, he clearly had some type of bias. Another thing that I think need to be pointed out to the court, he also said, and if you're talking about his experience, and the government says he didn't have direct experience, he actually said, I do watch these kids. And the point that he made about the difficult situation, when he was first asked about difficulty, was that he would have a preconceived notion that this is intolerable, this type of conduct. But it doesn't go about his impartiality. Then I'd like to turn to what the judge said. The judge said, and that's, unfortunately, I have this on the transcript instead of in our brief, but on page 167, he talks about, from the best of, from his recollection. Well, the judge remembered, and if, like I said, you need to look at the whole transcript, that he did say at the very beginning, before his answers were, he was asked follow-up questions, that he would be difficult to be fair. The judge said, that's what, to the best of my recollection. So that stuck in his mind. So yeah, he was there, but I don't know, for whatever reason, he didn't hear the other questions. And he also commented...
Counsel, you're out of time. Thank you.
I thought I had 27 seconds.
It's going in the other direction. Oh, you're over 27 seconds. Okay. Thank you, counsel, for your arguments today. We appreciate them. The case will stand as submitted. We will issue a written opinion in due course.